It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR. I'm your host, Marty Wegbray. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show...
Taking your name off the mortgage, that's not a very easy thing at all. You need to contact your mortgage company and talk to somebody there in the refinance department to see what's involved in getting the spouse that will remain the owner of the house qualified to take over that mortgage. But you've got to, in many, almost all cases, fill out a credit application and qualify on that loan on just one person's income before the other spouse can be released.
Private attorney Sandra Bowen explains how property acquired during a marriage gets divided during a divorce, and when an employee handbook or personnel manual does and does not give you enforceable legal rights is discussed during this week's question and answer. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 66, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's news you can use. The Center for Medicare Advocacy is launching a new initiative to eliminate the Medicare Improvement Standard. This requires that beneficiaries be able to improve in order to qualify for coverage, and unfairly restricts access to Medicare coverage and necessary health care. People with conditions such as Lou Gehrig's disease, multiple sclerosis, Alzheimer's disease, spinal cord injuries, Parkinson's disease, arthritis, and stroke are told Medicare coverage is not available if their underlying condition will not improve, if they have plateaued and are not likely to improve, or if they need maintenance care only. This keeps people with debilitating chronic conditions from receiving the care they need, even though the Medicare Act does not require improvement as a condition for coverage. For decades, the improvement standard has been among the most significant obstacles facing millions of people with Medicare who need medical and rehabilitative care for long-term conditions and injuries. For more information, go to www.medicareadvocacy.org. In other news, in response to a July complaint from the Minnesota Attorney General's office claiming deception and false advertising, the National Arbitration Forum, or NAF, the nation's largest consumer debt arbitration agency, agreed to stop arbitrating credit card cases nationwide. That case has made waves. Another consumer debt arbitration agency, the American Arbitration Association, or AAA, also has stopped hearing such cases. The AAA said its decision wasn't related to NAF's case, but it decided to stop taking arbitrations after an evaluation revealed, quote, weaknesses in the consumer debt collection arbitration process, unquote, according to its website. A congressional subcommittee, which began an investigation last year to study the fairness of mandatory arbitration, concluded in July that the current arbitration system is ripe for abuse and does not provide protection for consumers. A sweeping overhaul won't occur unless Congress decides whether to pass laws limiting how arbitration can be used. but arbitration experts now expect that more collection claims will be funneled into the courts. For more information, go to www.fairarbitrationnow.org. With this week's News You Can Use, this is your host, Marty Wegebright. Welcome back to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.
This week's legal term of the week is charge of discrimination. A charge of discrimination is a formal written complaint that a worker is required to file before filing a lawsuit claiming prohibited discrimination on the job. In Virginia, this charge must be filed with either the Federal Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, EEOC, or the Virginia Council on Human Rights. It must be filed within 300 days of the prohibited job discrimination, that is, different treatment based on race, religion, national origin, age, if 40 or older, gender, or disability. The charge usually is investigated within 180 days. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Diane Dussault, and charge of discrimination is this week's legal term of the week.
You're listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio. It's time once again for this week's question and answer. We're here in the studio with this week's questioner. Tell us your name and where you're from.
Walter Richmond.
Thank you, Walter, for being on the show. What question do we have this week?
Yes, I would like to know is after being terminated from an employer and they find out that they did not follow their own guidelines, do I have any legal recourse?
Let me ask a follow-up question to that. Was there some type of a personnel manual or employee handbook that they didn't follow?
Yes, there is.
And specifically, what in the handbook do you think they didn't follow?
Follow-up as write-up guidelines, written warnings, verbal warnings up to termination.
Okay, I see. So in other words, this employer had some sort of progressive discipline policy where you start with a verbal warning, then a written warning, possibly a suspension or probation, and then eventually leading up to termination.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Well, a lot of employers have a progressive discipline policy like that. It may be in a personnel manual or an employee handbook, or it may just be posted somewhere. The key thing, however, is to find some language in the employee handbook or personnel manual that says that this is binding on both the employer and the employee. And I dare say you're not likely, unfortunately, to find that language. Most personnel manuals and employee handbooks that I've seen, certainly over the past 10 years, have got somewhere some type of a disclaimer that says, this is advisory, this is guidance, this doesn't change the employment at will nature of this employment, and we can follow this or not follow this as we choose, which makes that employee handbook, that personnel manual, really not enforceable in law. It's at best advisory. It's at best, you know, gives them guidance, and it could be used, for example, in an unemployment compensation claim to show that you did not lose your job through some fault of yours because you did not receive the proper warnings. But in terms of going into court and saying, I was fired in violation of that, you would have a claim only if you read the entire personnel handbook, employee manual, and it was clearly not stated in there that this was advisory and only provided guidance and didn't give you any enforceable rights. Otherwise, if that statement's not in there, and again, I haven't seen a statement like that in 10 years, you might have a claim. Do you have access to the employee manual?
Not at this time. I do have access to parts regarding the progressive discipline on attendance.
Right. Well, you would need more than that. You would need access to the entire manual, cover to cover, because they typically put these things right at the beginning or right at the end. And if there's a disclaimer on there, you have no legal rights. If there's no disclaimer, you might have a claim. Do you think you might possibly have access to the whole manual at some point?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Well, if you do and that disclaimer is not in there, by all means, get in touch with us. Thank you so much for being on the show. We're here at the law offices of Coates and Davenport in the near west end of Henrico County, and we're speaking with Sandra Bowen, who has practiced law in Virginia for 30 years and family law for the past 20 years. Welcome to the show, Sandy.
Thank you, Marty.
We're going to be talking today about divorces with property issues in them and how the property gets divided in something that's called equitable distribution. So, Sandy, how does property get divided if people can't divide it themselves in a divorce situation?
Well, first of all, the courts do have the authority to step in and make decisions about marital property if parties can't agree. In my practice, I make sure that clients who come in who have issues with marital property make a copy of a code section called 20-107.3, and anybody can get to this by going on the web and just putting in your search engine Virginia Code, and when you get to the Virginia Code, put in section 20-107.3. This is the roadmap the courts use in making decisions about marital property. The very first step people need to take when approaching divorce where there are issues of assets or even debts is to make a list. Make a list of all the stuff. The real estate, the automobiles, any bank accounts, savings accounts, investment accounts, stock accounts, personal property items, and also anything either of you might have that's in the nature of a retirement benefit or an employment benefit. Make a list of all these things. The second list you need to prepare are all of the debts. What do you owe? Who do you owe it to? And how much is owed? And once you've got that list, then the analysis can begin.
So let's go back to the property. Does it matter whose name might be on the deed or the title or who paid for the property or who is primarily responsible for the property, or is it all just all lumped together?
It's actually all just lumped together. And the starting point really is, was it acquired during the marriage? It really doesn't matter whose name it's in, and it really doesn't matter who paid for it. As long as the money that was used to buy the asset is money that you made during the marriage, it's going to be a marital asset. There are many exceptions to this analysis, though. For example, if you inherited something, sold it, and then used the money to buy something else, it's entirely possible that something acquired during the marriage could take on that character of separate property that the item you got by inheritance originally had. So once you make the list of everything that was acquired during the marriage, regardless of how it's titled, then you need to start figuring out what these things are worth.
Now, typically people don't own the house free and clear, and they might not own the motor vehicles free and clear either. They'll owe something on it. Hopefully the asset is worth more than what's owed on it, and then there'll be some sort of equity, which is the difference between what it's worth and what's owed on it. So how does the equity get divided, particularly in a house? How do you get your half of the equity out if that's what's considered fair?
Well, it can be accomplished by way of selling the house, which unfortunately in this market can take a very long period of time. Or the house can be refinanced, and at the time of the refinancing, the money can come out to buy out the other spouse. But those kind of transactions really do need to have a lawyer involved, because the deed transferring the property and the contract that you need to write all should be drafted by an attorney.
Now, a lot of times we get questions from people who say, well, just take my name off the mortgage and take my name off the house, and that'll be sufficient. And how can that be done?
Well, you have to have a deed anytime you're changing the ownership name on a house. So you'll need a deed of some sort to transfer your interest to the other spouse. Taking your name off the mortgage, that's not a very easy thing at all. You need to contact your mortgage company and talk to somebody there in the refinance department to see what's involved in getting the spouse that will remain the owner of the house qualified to take over that mortgage. But you've got to, in many, almost all cases, fill out a credit application and qualify on that loan on just one person's income before the other spouse can be released.
So it's not a simple or easy process at all.
Not at all.
So you mentioned settlement agreement, and that's obviously one way to divide marital property. And I suppose the other way is to let the judge decide it. Do you find that the judge will make a fair decision? And what does the judge look at to make a fair decision?
Well, the courts, especially the courts around here, they apply a great deal of common sense when deciding what to do with marital property. They will try in every way possible to keep from selling the home if that is what is really important to somebody. But the court does have the authority to require that whoever keeps the home refinance the deed of trust mortgage to release the other spouse. But the courts around here work very hard to make sure that the outcomes are fair and make sense. If it's the car that you drive, the court's going to give you that car. Around here, our courts are not too interested in making determinations about who keeps the dining room furniture, who keeps the bedroom furniture, who gets the power saw, who gets the electric appliances. They really do require that people work that out between themselves. They just don't get involved in litigating items of what we call tangible personal property, the things that are in your home. The court will also make decisions about retirement accounts. And separately from deciding how to allocate all of the marital equity and debt, the court will make a decision about any retirement benefits that have been earned in the marriage, and will make a decision about how to divide those. If in your divorce there are retirement benefits that get divided, if you're not the person who earned the benefits, in other words, the employee spouse, before you can get any of those benefits turned over to you, you've got to have a special court order entered. It just isn't enough to have the court divorce you. There has to be a special court order.
And is that what we call a quadro, a qualified domestic relations order?
That's right. It goes by its initials, QRDO. And again, those are pretty specialized documents, and it's pretty valuable benefits. So it's always worth your while to have a lawyer involved in making sure that that court order is written, and written in a way that the employer's plan administrator is going to understand it and make the division that's been decided in that order. Another real important point is, after the divorce is done, if you're the person who earned those benefits during the marriage, you need to go and change your beneficiary designations on your plan to whoever the new person is going to be who you intend to receive those benefits. Because it happens too many times that a person's divorced, the former spouse is still named as beneficiary, then they die, and the former spouse gets those benefits, when in the meantime, they've remarried and maybe even started a new family, and that was never their intention.
So the mere fact of the divorce doesn't change the beneficiary at all. A separate action has to be done by the employee.
That's exactly right.
So let's talk about how the judge is going to decide, I guess, what percent each party gets. Is there any type of assumption that it's going to be a 50-50 split? And if the judge, if there's not that assumption, how does the judge make that decision of 50-50 or 75-25 or 90-10 or even 100-0?
Well, Marty, there is no assumption in the law in Virginia that 50-50 is a one-size-fits-all outcome. It's an equitable decision. And in this instance, equitable means fair, fair under all of the circumstances. Well, what circumstances are relevant are those that are described in 20-107.3, the code section that the court considers in making decisions about how to divide assets. We find in this area often that after considering everything, the courts often believe 50-50 is the right outcome for a family. But that's not to say that every single asset gets divided 50-50. Some things can be divided unequally, 40-30. And we see that happening around here too. But that's where preparing your evidence to match the factors that the court considers is really an important part of putting a good case on in front of a judge so that you can get a good result.
And what are briefly some of those factors that the court's going to look at that you mentioned in the Code of Virginia?
The court wants to know, what kind of monetary contributions have each of the spouses made towards acquiring and caring for these assets? But as important to monetary contributions are also non-monetary contributions. So that's not to say that where a family has unequal earnings during a marriage and assets were acquired with those earnings, that the higher earning spouse is going to automatically get a bigger share. That's because these non-monetary contributions count too. And in some families, the end of the marriage comes because somebody has breached the trust or breached the promises in the marriage. Sometimes that can be considered by a court as a negative non-monetary contribution to the family.
So who's at fault could definitely be a factor the judge looks at.
In a way, and that's where it would come in. Sometimes substance abuse or alcoholism, frequent job changes, or periods of long unemployment can be considered by courts as negative non-monetary contributions. But these are really acts that are more in contradiction to the promises that were made in the beginning to work hard in a marriage. The length of the marriage is something the court considers. Tax consequences can be considered. The type of asset that you're dealing with can be considered.
Well, Sandy, that all sounds very complex, and I think this interview has hopefully cut through some of that complexity. We've been speaking with Sandy Bowen. She is a family law attorney with the firm of Coates and Davenport here in the near west end of Henrico County. Thank you very much for being on the show, Sandy.
Thank you, Marty.
This week's top three tips are about equitable distribution. The first tip is that equitable distribution is the fair division of marital property during a divorce. The second tip is that marital property is all the property you or your spouse got during the marriage and before you separated, with a few exceptions, no matter whose name is on the deed or title, and no matter who paid for the property. The third tip is that if the parties cannot agree, a judge will decide the fairest way to divide marital property. This may be all to the wife or all to the husband or anything in between. Virginia law does not assume marital property should be divided 50-50. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Michelle King. And for this week, that's our top three tips about equitable distribution.
That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. If you have any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. In addition, every first-run Central Virginia Legal Aid radio show ever broadcast is now available at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the numeral 4, all.net. Then click the contributor link, then click Marty Wegbright, Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. Virginia's 2010 legislative session begins on January 14, and pre-filing of proposed bills begins next Monday. Tune in next Wednesday at 12 noon for a special one-hour live broadcast as we talk with Virginia Poverty Law Center attorneys Jay Spear, Christy Mara, and Sushila Varkey about consumer, foster care, domestic violence, and other family law issues confronting the General Assembly next year. That's Law for the Rest of Us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wainwright.